Ah, yes, it's Friday. Bonus podcast day. The Friday special. Get you set up for the weekend. Sometimes a run of the Friday specials is a mixed bag. But it isn't this spring. For the next few weeks, we've got a sequence going. One of Helena's art appreciation art history courses. Started last Friday, March 25th, the first Friday of this spring. Doesn't mean you have to listen to them in order, or listen to all of them. They're each self-contained, a good listen in their own right. Just as you can listen, with a lot of enjoyment, to one of the four concerti of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. But if you listen to the whole thing, well, you've increased your enjoyment and satisfaction. A brief word about art historian Helena. She's an Oxford graduate. History and art were and are her subjects. She's a brilliant guide. They just don't come any better than Helena Jones. I'll just push out two stories here, which, combined, get her into focus. An American friend, he's a big deal in corporate America, the most successful American I know, was in Helena's thrall. When he was in London, he would always ask which walks she'd be doing during his stay. Christopher memorably said, "I could listen to that little blonde all day." Well, yeah, I know it's not politically correct, but it is what it is. It's the assessment of a high-powered, tax-sharp American executive who doesn't suffer fools, who doesn't have time for waffle or anything less than the first rate. That was Christopher. Now me, David. I also am enthralled to Helena's art talks. I learned so much from them, and I now have done a lot of podcasts, getting on for 600 of them. 99 out of 100 times, I script mine and then record them. I assumed Helena was doing the same, because they're so well put together, she's so articulate, so assured, they're delivered so beautifully. My jaw dropped when she said, "No, I don't script them, I just do them." I'm still stunned, almost in a state of disbelief, certainly in a state of wonder and renewed appreciation. That's it. Every time I listen to her from now on, I'm aware. I'm thinking, she's doing this unscripted, off the cuff. That's a measure of both her command of her subject and the range and power of her mind. In academic terms, she'd be one of those rarities, an upper first. I've never asked her, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if she was an Oxford upper first. When you listen, just keep it in mind. She's doing this unscripted. It'll add to your enjoyment and appreciation. Okay, here's Helena. Here's part two of her spring 2022 Friday special art appreciation course.
Hello, everyone. It's Helena here. Welcome back to part two of my podcast on the Old Marylebone Walk, the Wallace Collection, and a few of the paintings within the gallery. At the end of part one of my podcast, I mentioned that the fourth Marquess of Hertford, who is a great connoisseur of the arts and responsible for building up the bulk of the painting collection, acquired two paintings in 1865, which are arguably the most celebrated paintings in the museum. One of those is Frans Hals, The Laughing Cavalier of 1624, and that will be the subject of this part of my podcast. Hals, alongside Vermeer and Rembrandt, is now seen as one of the great masters of the golden age of Dutch art. The title, The Laughing Cavalier, was first used in 1888, when the painting was on display at the Royal Academy. It's a very catchy title and is still used to this day. And it helps account for the iconic status of the painting. But it is somewhat misleading, because the man is not a cavalier and he's not laughing. We don't in fact know the identity of the sitter. We only know that he was 26 years of age when the painting was completed. That information is given at the top right-hand corner of the picture. However, we can make some reasonable assumptions about the man, judging from his appearance and the social conditions of his time. For a start, he's clearly a man of the world, who takes great care over his appearance and likes to ensure that he's totally up to date in his dress. so he's wearing the latest fashion from France, the embroidered slash doublet, introduced into Holland in the 1620s, as well as the flat, lace-layered collars, beginning to replace the stiff, pleated ruffs. And he literally crowns his appearance with this magnificent black hat, wide-brimmed, upturned, cocked to the right. It beautifully frames his face, where we notice in particular his upturned moustache and the neatly trimmed beard. He's also clearly a man of wealth and high social status. These garments would have been extremely expensive, both in terms of the material used, particularly the lace, and the time invested to produce them. Think, for example, of all the hours it would have taken embroidering those signs and symbols onto his magnificent doublet. And though it isn't often noticed straight away, the man is wearing a fine sword or rapier. We can see its top or pommel in the crook of his left elbow. Only those in the upper echelons of society were permitted to wear such important status symbols. He's also a well-educated man, because the signs and symbols on his embroidered jacket, which were taken from emblem books of the time, make classical references, which only a man of learning would recognise and understand. The gentleman may have made his money through business, and we can make that deduction from his association with the artist. Frans Hals spent most of his working life in Haarlem, Holland, which was a thriving city port, and was associated with two industries in particular, the production of textiles and beer. Hals made a niche for himself in portraiture, and many of his clients came from the world of business. Merchants, bankers, tradespeople, publicans. So our sitter probably belonged to one of those professions. The most popular theory is that he was a merchant. Also, one of the symbols on his doublet is that of Mercury, the winged messenger. He's identified by the winged cap and the caduceus, or staff. Now, Mercury, among other things, was associated with good fortune and commerce, so that is probably a deliberate reference to the sitter's profession. Finally, it's reasonable to assume that our gentleman was a bachelor, for two main reasons. The first is to do with his flamboyant clothing. It was common practice in Holland at this time for single men to wear loose-fitting, brightly coloured clothing to denote their single, carefree status. When they married, they would adopt the colour black and wear more sombre, tight-fitting dress. In actual fact, the gentleman is wearing a lot of black in his garments, from the hat to the doublet to the cloak, which is draped over his shoulder and tied like a sash around his waist. But the colour is broken up through the red and gold embroidery on the doublet, the white lace collar and cuffs, and the white linen shirt pulled through the slashing of the doublet to introduce this striking colour contrast. So while Van Gogh might have marvelled at the way in which Frans Hals was able to use 27 different shades of black, here the black is tempered with the introduction of other colours. And the second reason why we may assume that this man is a bachelor is because of the direction in which he's pointing, to our left and his right. It was conventional in Dutch society at this time that if a man was married, he would have a pendant or companion portrait done of his wife at the same time as his. The tradition was that the wife would stand on the left-hand side of her husband and they'd be turned towards each other. So when the portraits were hung on the wall, it would appear as though they were looking at each other. So by this convention, the husband would always be turned towards his left-hand side. But as we can see in this picture, the sitter is turned to the right. So from this, we can deduce that the painting was commissioned as a single portrait, reflecting his bachelor status. So to conclude, our laughing cavalier is probably a wealthy merchant of bachelor status. Now let's turn to the question of his expression. Is he laughing? I don't think so. Smiling then? I would say that he's more smirking, looking very smug. very, very pleased with himself. Full of self-importance, self-confidence, and, well, full of himself. He's made a good deal of money from his profession and is very proud of his status, his achievements, his success, his wealth, and is supremely self-confident about his accomplishments, about his abilities, and his personal tastes in all matters. And this self-confidence and pride isn't just reflected in his expression, but also in his posture, which is self-assured, cocky, almost bordering on the arrogant. Look how he stands, with his left hand on his hip, elbow akimbo. It's a very dramatic use of foreshortening, because the elbow breaks out of the picture plane into our space. In turn, we're brought right up to the sitter. He's placed deliberately in the foreground of the painting. So it's up close and personal. Not a comfortable place for the viewer to be in, because those bright blue vivid eyes, set above the red rosy cheeks, may be sparkling, but they're looking down on us, as though the sitter is judging us, regarding us very much as his social inferior. And he never takes his eyes off you. Like the Mona Lisa, he follows you all around the room. You never escape his gaze. So if we wanted a title that more accurately described the man and his profession, we could call this painting The Smug Dutch Businessman. But somehow, I don't think it'll catch on. And while The Laughing Cavalier may be somewhat misleading, I think it perfectly captures the essence of this man, his supreme self-confidence and pride, his flamboyant dress, his larger-than-life personality, and his passion for high-style luxury living. This is very much a glass half-full man, a man you'd notice when he entered the room. So for all its inaccuracies, I think the title Laughing Cavalier will do, for a little while longer at least. But the title alone won't explain why this is one of the most famous paintings in the world, so much so that it's often referred to as the Dutch Mona Lisa. And its image has been countlessly reproduced, not just in art formats like postcards or posters, but also as gift souvenirs, such as chocolate boxes, biscuit tins, teapots, jigsaw puzzles, tote bags. Well, I think once again, there are two reasons which help account for its timeless, universal appeal. One factor is that viewers are as fascinated today as the contemporaries of Hal's were by the intricate details shown on the costume, notably the lacework and the embroidery of the doublet. With regard to the embroidery, the signs and symbols we see on the doublet were taken from emblem books, very popular at the time. And Hal's does not cut corners. He doesn't give us simplified versions of the symbols, as might have been expected at that time. This level of detail is quite unprecedented. So if you compare an emblem in the book with a symbol in the painting, they match perfectly, with every single detail included. But more importantly, Hals doesn't give a painted version of the symbol. Through his incredible brushwork, he simulates the appearance of embroidered thread. Now, the symbols shown in the jacket are many and varied. We've noted the figure of Mercury, represented by the winged hat and the caduceus or staff, and there's also references to fortitude or strength, but of the use of the symbol of the obelisk. But there are also many symbols referring to the pains and pleasures of love. So you have symbols of Cupid with his wings and bow and arrow, you have the lover's knots, and the flaming cornucopia. And you also have the insect, the bee, which represents through its honey the sweetness and pleasure of love, and through its sting, its pain. Now, these references to love have led to the suggestion that this might be a betrothal portrait, but it's much more likely that this simply reflects a young man who's already experienced the emotional upheaval with all its complexities and contradictions of falling in and being in love. With regard to the lacework, note how Howes has meticulously reproduced the geometric pattern on the cuff of the sleeve. And as with the embroidered thread, Howes doesn't just give us a replica of the design. He renders beautifully for us the texture and material of the garment. So if you look at the collar, for example, we're given a real sense of the delicacy, the crispness, and the lightness of the material, as well as its intricate pattern. And then these areas where there is meticulous attention to detail and the work is finished to a high degree contrast with other areas where Howes has used much freer brush strokes. Take, for example, the cloak, which is partly draped around the sitter's shoulder and partly tied to form a sash around his waist. That's achieved by a few confident strokes of the brush, as are the upper parts of the sleeve cuffs. And when you look at the whole ensemble, the magnificent black hat, the delicate lacework of the sleeves and collar, and the sumptuous, shimmering black doublet, with the crisp white linen shirt pulled through the slashing features and beautifully embroidered with gold and red thread. Well, all of this makes for a wonderful visual experience. A vision which never fails to capture and captivate every new generation of eyes who encounter this amazing work. And the second reason why I believe The Laughing Cavalier has such universal timeless appeal is because Frans Hals doesn't just present us with a lifelike image of the sitter. He presents us with their living presence. That is what contemporaries used to marvel at. The way in which Hals gave his sitters such vitality and life. And like his contemporaries, we don't feel that we're looking at a fixed and permanent image of the sitter. Rather, we see them as a living person, caught in a passing moment or a fleeting, transitory expression. Perhaps the nearest modern equivalent is the live photo option on your mobile phone's camera. And that's when you press the button to take the picture. It records several seconds of video before taking the shot. So when you play it back, you've always got an animated photo of your subject. Perhaps the best way I can express the impact of this portrait on the viewer is as follows. Imagine yourself in a room entirely on your own. Alone, that is, except for the painting on one of the walls of the room of The Laughing Cavalier. And what you will feel very strongly is the sense that you are not on your own. And the person whose presence you sense is that person in the picture frame, the man known as The Laughing Cavalier. And here, I'm not reporting on other people's experiences. I'm reflecting on my own. Never have I felt so much the living presence of a portrait than when standing in front of The Laughing Cavalier. I feel I'm being watched wherever I go. As I've said before, just like the Mona Lisa. He watches you wherever you go, looking at you, judging you. It's the most unsettling, unnerving experience. A 17th century Dutch schoolmaster, Theodorus Trevelius, gave a very succinct summary of the qualities that made Howes' portraits so exceptional. By his extraordinary manner of painting, which is uniquely his, he virtually surpasses everyone. His paintings are imbued with such force and vitality that he seems to defy nature itself with his brush. And it was this energetic brushwork, swift, free and fluid, which gave his sitters an irresistible appearance of life. Now, ironically, it was his lack of finish that caused him to be criticised by many artists and was an important reason why he fell into relative obscurity after his death. The widespread view was that artists should strive very hard to hide their brushstrokes by blending them in very carefully to achieve a highly polished finish and appearance. And yet it was this very unique brushwork, much criticised by other artists, swift, brusque, disjointed, which imbued Halsey's sitters with such energy and life. Now, it has to be confessed that Halsey's apparent spontaneity of brushwork did in fact reflect hours of careful observation and practice. Now, although Halsey did some genre paintings and family portraits, most of his work were single half-length portraits. And so, because this was his speciality, he could develop and then adopt a simple working practice which made every portrait quicker and easier to complete. In his portraits, there's usually very little background, so nothing to distract the viewer from concentrating their attentions on the sitter, who's usually placed in the foreground of the picture. The light always comes from the left-hand side from a single light source, and this enabled Halsey to develop a very instinctive and deep grasp of the appearance of different types of faces under this very specific light source. Having mastered this basic principle, he could then focus on the individual variations which he noticed in each sitter and reproduce these with a few very confident strokes of his brush. And so what might appear spontaneous and effortless was in fact based on a well-prepared and practiced procedure. Nonetheless, the fact that he worked without any underlying drawings, applying paint direct to the canvas, well, the bravura of his brushwork, the confidence with which he applied every single stroke, with such unerring accuracy and precision, is simply breathtaking. But Halsey didn't just bring his sitters to life. He gave them personality and character. And he did this in a very honest way. He wasn't a Van Dyck or a Gainsborough who would capture the perfect likeness of a sitter, but enhance their appearance in the process. And this is why their portraits were so popular, because the sitter could recognise themselves in the portrait, that was crucial, but they never realised just how handsome or beautiful they were until it was revealed to them through the hand of the artist. So it was portraiture designed to flatter the sitter, to enhance their appearance. That was not Halsey's approach at all. No, if you had pimples, wrinkles, bags under your eyes, double chin, receding hairline, bulging waistline, these features would all be reflected in your portrait by Halsey. It wouldn't be a flattering portrait, but it would be a truthful one and honest. And that is again what contemporaries marvelled at. They didn't just recognise the appearance of the sitter, they could recognise their personality, their character, their inner soul. And that's what gives them their timeless appeal. Contemporaries believed in the portrait, and we do too. We believe that these people really lived, and we can recognise their personality and character traits in people we know today. So when we look at the Laughing Cavalier, we can make a good stab at assessing his personality. He was probably a bit pompous, full of himself, boastful, and certainly very confident. But also probably a man who was very generous, kind-hearted, with a good nature and great sense of humour. A man who would light up any room that he entered, you'd notice his presence. And he'd bring joyfulness and laughter to any company he was present in. A forceful personality who would make an indelible impression on your memory. Now, if you visit the Wallace Collection before the end of January 2022, you won't find the portrait of the Laughing Cavalier on display in the main picture gallery. In the frame which normally houses the painting, there's been placed a rapier, which comes from the Arms and Armaments Collection of the Wallace Museum. And this splendid rapier or sword closely resembles the one worn by the Laughing Cavalier in the picture. And it has been put there to indicate the fact that the Laughing Cavalier is currently in a special exhibition in the Wallace Collection about Franz Halsey and the male portrait. Although Halsey did portraits of women, children and families, Critics generally regard his portraits of men to be his finest works. And so this is the focus of this special exhibition. The Wallace Collection have been loaned 12 of the finest male portraits by Frans Hals from all over the world. And these are displayed in the exhibition together with their own portrait, The Laughing Cavalier. And by setting the portrait in the context of the whole range of Hals's career, because the paintings on loan range from the earliest in the 1610s through to the latest in the 1660s, it's hoped that this will facilitate a deeper appreciation and understanding of this iconic work. In the introductory room, there is a large print of Haarlem in the 1620s, where Hals spent most of his working life, together with the earliest exhibit in the collection, A Man with a Skull. The main exhibition room is very open, in the shape of a long rectangle. And the concept behind this display is to evoke the atmosphere of a grand dinner party, where you have the guests seated round the table. So the Laughing Cavalier is at the head of the table, the short end of the rectangle. Facing him is the latest painting in date order, and then the remaining paintings are hung in pairs on either side of the long walls. And the idea is that the sitters will be communicating with each other, interacting with each other, as well as the viewers to the exhibition. So the curators are very keen to convey this idea of the sitters having a living presence, which is the key feature of Hals's work. And the Wallace Collection hope that through this first major exhibition of Hals's work in this country since the 1990, of restoring Frans Hals's reputation as being one of the great old masters in the golden age of Dutch art, alongside Vermeer and Rembrandt. Although Hals had a very successful artistic career, after his death, he quickly fell into relative obscurity. This was partly due to criticisms of his dissolute lifestyle. He had a fiery temperament and was always getting into arguments. He drank heavily. He lived beyond his means and was sued by his butcher, baker, and shoemaker for unpaid bills. But he was also criticised for his artistic style. Many people didn't like its lack of finish, although, as we've seen, it was this spirited brushwork that gave his sitters such vitality and life. It wasn't, in fact, until the later part of the 19th century that his reputation was restored. Many of the Impressionist artists admired his free and spontaneous brushwork and regarded him as their precursor. But perhaps the single most important event which led to the reassessment of his work and the establishment of his reputation as one of the great artists of the 17th century was the acquisition by the 4th Marquess of Hertford of the Laughing Cavalier painting in the auction room in March 1865. The Marquess was very keen to acquire the painting, but so too was one of his great friends and rivals in the auction room, the Baron Rothschild, like the Marquess, incredibly wealthy. So a bidding war took place, and it was the Marquess who triumphed. The estimated value of the painting was 8,000 francs, and the Marquess of Hertford paid over 51,000 francs for it, so six times the estimated value. The story was sensational and made newspaper headlines and helped focus the spotlight on the artist and his work for the first time in over 200 years. Well, The Laughing Cavalier was one of the two great paintings bought by the Marquess of Hertford in 1865. In part three of my podcast, I'll be focusing on the second painting acquired that year, and the painting which became the inspiration behind this podcast. So I hope very much to enjoy your company once again for part three of the talk.